Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Harold Cry grew up in the Arkansas Delta and came to Memphis to attend Memphis State University. After graduating, he went to work for a real estate firm and thought that he could do things better. So he started Cry Like Realtors that became one of the largest real estate firms in the entire Southeast.
In this conversation, you will hear the passion and drive that Harold Cry has for building and running his business, which explains what goes on under the hood for a lot of entrepreneurs. Enjoy our conversation with Harold Cry.
Well, good morning. We're so excited to have Harold Cry here with us today for our episode of Entrepreneurial Insights. Harold, welcome. We're really excited to have you and looking forward to hearing all about you and Cry Like and everything else. And I just want to get started with, would you do a real quick elevator pitch for what is Cry Like? What business do you have?
We're a large real estate company, 3,200 sales agents, 130 offices, a mortgage company, a title company, an insurance agency, a property management, commercial sales, 600 employees plus 3,200 sales associates that are independent contractors, and been in business about 43 years. And we're one of the largest real estate companies, particularly privately owned real estate companies in the United States.
And I know you started in Memphis, but now you're in how many
started
states?
Started in Memphis, and we're in nine states now. We're in cities like Nashville, Chattanooga, Little Rock, Jackson, Mississippi, Huntsville, Alabama, Knoxville, Atlanta. And still growing, adding sales associates and that type thing.
Wonderful. Now, if I can backtrack that so that our listeners now have an understanding of what you do, now we want to hear who you are. So tell us where did you grow up? Did you grow up in Memphis, born, raised?
The short story on that is grew up in Arkansas, little town, Osceola, Arkansas, 5,006 population on the sign as you came into Osceola. And I was born in an even smaller town. Little town that is near Little Rock called Des Arc, Arkansas. My dad was a Arkansas state policeman because he grew up in a farming community, and probably World War II was a good thing for him because it got him in the Navy and got him out of the little town where the only way you could make a living was sawmills and picking cotton, and then he became a policeman. And there was something going on that Dwight D. Eisenhower had put in called the Interstate Highway System. And they were hiring a lot of people to be highway patrol people, and that was my dad's job. He's deceased now, but 35 years as an Arkansas State policeman. His duty assignments were in West Memphis, Osceola, and Jonesboro. And so I grew up in Osceola, and Arkansas State was in Jonesboro, was the closest college, and is one that I could afford to go to. Obviously, when your dad's a policeman, that wasn't a career that I wanted to follow. And so I went to school at Arkansas State and majored in business administration. And I won't say that getting into real estate and owning a real estate company was part of the ambition or goal, because quite truthfully, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to be when I got out of college, and Vietnam was going on. So I went through the ROTC program and went in as an officer in the Army. I spent some time in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Fort Lee, Virginia, Fort Hood, Texas, and 1 year in Seoul, Korea. And so that was a two-year commitment for the United States Army from being in, having a minor in military science through the ROTC program, that every kid, if you were an able-bodied kid in those days, because we still had the draft. People don't realize we still had the draft in those days and concerned about getting drafted. So I said, don't worry about getting drafted. Go ahead and volunteer and go through a college program and go in as an officer. The pay's better.
What got you to Memphis, Tennessee?
Well, when you get out of the Army, and I got out of the Army in 1969 in Osceola, small town, not a whole lot of jobs, didn't want to be a policeman. like my dad was. And so you come to Memphis and you start interviewing these companies that charge you a fee to find you a job. And I found they found me a job, took the first one I could find. By that time, I already had a wife and a son. And so you want to get out of your parents' back bedroom and get out of your place of your own. And so I took the first job that was offered to me, and that was with a company called Container Corporation of America. They made cardboard boxes, corrugated containers, we call them, and worked there for a few years. And $700 a month, that was what they were paying college graduates at that point in time. And started working, there wasn't enough money for me, so I started working loading freight at night of a union scale at Arkansas Best Freight. That was a few blocks from where I was working at Container Corporation, saving money. Saved like $3,000 to make a down payment on my first house. It was over in Fox Meadows here in Memphis. $27,700, $27,700. Put $3,000 down that I'd saved working at the truck line at night loading freight. I mean, this was with the college degree, and I was making more money with union scale than I was at the other job that took a college degree to get. Saved that money, made the down payment. And a funny story, 3286 Fox Chase in Fox Meadows and near the golf course there, if you're familiar with that. My house note was going to be $223 a month. When I told my dad I was buying his house and my house note was going to be $223 a month, he said, "Son, you've lost your mind. How in the world are you ever going to be able to make a $223 a month house payment?" And I said, "I don't know. They said I qualified." And so we did. We made that payment. And because I had VA benefits, I was a veteran, so because I had those benefits, I could go to school, or I had a degree, but I could go to school at the University of Memphis, Memphis State at the time, and take a couple of night classes, and my VA benefits would pay me like $350 a month. I said, "That's pretty good. I'll go take some extra classes." And said, "Go there, what classes do you want to take?" And I said, "Yeah, I've always been a little interested in real estate, but I didn't know anybody that could make a career in real estate. House I bought from the builder. No agent involved." And so taking the class in real estate, and at the end of the class, people were talking about taking this test and getting your license. And I said, "Now, how does that go? How does that work?" And so I met a guy by the name of Barry Sterling with the Sterling Company. They're not in business any longer, but we're here for years. And they hired me, and I went to work for them. And that first year, I made $11,000. $11,000 was better than the $700 a month I was making before, which is $8,400 a year. So $11,000. But there was something that they didn't tell you. That was, you got expenses off of that $11,000. Board fees, MLS dues, and advertising expenses, things like that. And so net, I made less than I made. But your first year is a learning experience. Your second year, you really begin to kind of rack up, I guess, additional sales and get a little more confidence and get more, maybe even some people that knew you, that knew that you hadn't been in real estate very long, were not as likely to want to use you since they knew you didn't have much experience. So second year, they were more likely to use you. So, well, he's going to make it. And so the second year, the income jumped up substantially. And so that's And while I was there at that company, a Sterling Company, after the first year, they said, "This guy's pretty sharp. We can make him a sales manager." So I became a sales manager and worked for them for 3 more years. And I said, "I'm the one that's driving the train here. I'm the one that's making everything go." We were expanding, hiring agents, training agents, and it seemed like I was the one that everyone was relating to. I said, "I think I can do this on my own." And so I met there at that company a guy named Dick Like. And the two of us started Cry Like in 1977.
Wow. Did you know anybody that had started or grown their own business in Osceola? So
no. In a little town, Osceola, there was one guy, I think, that did real estate, but he did insurance and notary and a little bit of everything, because there wasn't enough sales in a little town, enough transfers that you could make a living at it, that's for sure. I didn't know anybody. When I got in, the only person I knew was a home builder that I bought a house from, but no real estate agents. And so Barry Sterling, the guy that hired me, he and his brother Harold taught me a lot. And so that was the first company that I worked for and where I met Dick Like and some of the other people that later joined us.
What was the journey at Cry Like from just two guys wanting to be independent to growing it into a really larger, sustainable company?
That's probably the interesting sidebar on that is that we didn't have a grand plan. And anybody that says they got a grand plan is probably smoking something. But our grand plan was to have about 20 agents And the initial space we leased at 6263 Poplar Towers, we took a small space, enough for about 20 agents. And we thought if we could get 20 agents, we'd have enough agents that we'd be happy with that. Well, 3,000 agents later, we're still growing, but we filled up that space with the 20 agents in probably the first couple of months. And then we said, hey, before the paint was dry on the space that we went into some temporary space in the building first. And then I'd jokingly say our first sales meeting, all of our agents sat on a couch for the first sales meeting that we had in that building. And then took more space and grew more agents and more space. And then we said, you know, we tried to hire some agents that worked mostly Bartlett. And they said, no, we can't come all the way to Poplar. If you had a Bartlett office, we'd join you. And so I looked around and bought a lot, and we built a building out there and opened up a Bartlett office. Once you decide to expand, if you look around the country, most real estate companies have one office and 5 or 10 agents, most real estate companies. Most of them don't look to expand to a second, third, fourth. So once you make that decision to expand, then you got to have other procedures in place to be able to handle. How do you get the checks out to them out there? So you got to have a courier. How about yard signs? How do you get that out to the agent? So then you got to have a van. So all those things kind of entered into the equation. And once you've done that first office, you might as well do several more. So then we opened up one in Raleigh, one in Whitehaven, and now we got one in Germantown and one in Cordova and one out in Arlington. So we just continued to Midtown, continued to grow. Along that period of time, Dick Light became president of the local association, and then later on I was in leadership at the local association. And part of the journey of being in the leadership at the local association is that you then get to go to state meetings, the state of Tennessee meetings, and you meet agents from across the state. And so the state meetings were always in Nashville, so you go to Nashville and you spend a night and you go to a bunch of meetings. At night you'd go out to dinner with everybody. And I'd usually meet people from other parts of the state. And so there in Nashville, I said, well, who's the biggest company in Nashville? And nobody could tell me. And they said, oh, I don't know. So-and-so's got some agents. But I said, well, if you ask that question in Memphis, I guarantee you 99% of the people are going to say Cry Like by a long shot. And so I said, you know, if nobody knows who the biggest is, maybe we need to come up here and we'll be the biggest. This was before cell phones. So I'm driving up there and stopping off in a Shoney's, using their payphone, making phone calls, and began buying buildings, opening up new offices and hiring agents, and driving back and forth, going up on a Monday night and coming back on a Thursday night. And after about 7 or 8 years, that driving with 18-wheelers and everything got pretty tiring. I said, you know, if I knew how to fly an airplane, then that would be so much easier. We wouldn't have to worry about wrecks and worry about traffic stoppages and all that kind of stuff. So I started taking pilot lessons, and I finally got my pilot's license. But one of the things that you learn is that you need someone that is focused full time on flying and not in the air thinking about a real estate deal when they should be thinking about how to fly the airplane. So we hired a pilot pretty quickly, and that makes the journey a whole lot easier. Instead of 3 hours and something this morning to get into here, it was about 40 minutes. About a 40-minute flight to get out to Olive Branch, Mississippi.
Not a bad commute, really.
Yeah, for sure. So what did you do to attract the best agents? Because it seemed like that was part of your growth trajectory, was just getting people to buy into Cry Like.
One, by the time we opened up again, I'd been in with the Sterling Company for 4 years, and Dick had been there about 3.5. So we already had a reputation within the industry of being good guys, being honest and fair and that type of thing. And that's what people are looking for. And so when we left, we immediately had people that wanted to come with us. And like I say, we outgrew our original space, which was 1,900, 2,000 square feet. We outgrew that before the paint was dry. And before we actually moved in, we took additional space and then kept growing. And a lot of companies would have just stopped at one office, but we opened that second office, then the third, and then went to other cities. And once you go to other cities, then other people realize that you're willing to do that. And so we expanded. Next expansion was into Chattanooga, where somebody called me and said, you ever thought about coming to Chattanooga? And I said, no, not really. And they said, well, you really ought to. Things are going good over here. And would you come over? And because we got a company we'd like to sell. and they want to sell their company. And I said, I'll look, but I'm not sure. Long story, we ended up buying a company and opened up in Chattanooga. That was a third city they opened up in. But the growth was, you don't know. You don't know when you go out and open up an office and you put your sign up. You don't know where you're going to be. Is it just going to be Cry and Like? It's going to be two agents and nobody wants to join us because the biggest company in the town at that time was a Sterling company. And we said, I'm not sure we can compete with them. They had two offices, maybe 100 agents, and we were a new startup. Could we get any listings? Would people trust us as a new startup? Could we attract any sales agents? And so it was dicey during those first 3 years. By the time we got to the third year, we had become the largest, but there were several companies that were neck and neck with us at that point in time. You may remember there's a company called Popper Pike. I don't know if you remember that name. There was a company called Dan Stewart. Dan Stewart was a Channel 13 anchorman, 6 o'clock news, and he had a company that was doing well. So Cry Like, Dan Stewart, and Popper Pike, and the Sterling Company, four companies all were about dead even after 3 years. And we kept growing, and they died off. They closed their doors eventually.
One thing that I wanted to ask about is the fact that you and Dick did come in as partners, and that's sort of, I mean, unusual, and y'all have kept such a great relationship through the years. How do you think all of that works? Do you have different roles within the company?
We have different roles, and a partnership, a corporation that we're 50-50 partners, and so that is something that is like a, it's not unlike a marriage, I guess, in that you think you know everything about that partner, but you're not totally sure. And you think you know everything about that spouse, but you're not totally sure until you're actually living with them a long time, I guess. And so we've been partners for 40-something years. But as we started, we figured out what our roles would be. He was a salesperson and liked to sell, but didn't like the management decision-making type things. So that kind of fell on me. I was a top salesperson, multimedia, all sales club also, but always had leadership, I guess, in me. I was class president my junior year and senior year in high school, and then leadership role in the Army and that type thing. So leadership role in Exchange Club and JCs and those things in younger days. And so somebody has to be the person that is the thinker, the person that figures out the direction and what's the next step and what are the policies, what are the rules, what are you going to be dealing with? And that was me. That was my job, was to figure out all of the things that the company needs. And so initially I was wore every hat from the janitor of the to the CEO to the CFO to the HR department. You're a one-man show running all those things. Now we got 600 employees, so there's somebody who wears all those hats. And so you have to grow in your role, and that you begin to, as you get bigger, you have to let some of those positions go to other people who can focus on it full time, because you find yourself probably taking shortcuts on things that you don't need to take if you're trying to run all those things. And as we got bigger with the 600 employees, then you begin to get HR issues that you're going to have to deal with, and setting vacation policies and 401ks and all type of employment issues that you get into. And we're in a number of different industries, but they all relate back to real estate. First, we list the house, then we sell the house, and then we have to get a mortgage for the borrower most of the time. Let's pay cash. So they got to get a loan, and then they got to get homeowner's insurance, and they got to have a closing. That's a title company. And we have warranties, do warranty sales if they want to get a warranty on appliances, that type of thing. So we tend to cover all the bases for somebody, commercial insurance, commercial sales, but they all spin off of real estate. The residential real estate is kind of the swizzle that stirs a drink. Everything else spins off of that. You don't need a mortgage company unless you got the real estate company who's making the sales. You don't need a title company, you got the real estate agent making the sales. And so we figured out that we have to be a one-stop shop, that we have to have all those tools that are available for the customer to make their, and the real estate agent, to make their life easier and make the whole process simpler and easier. Because all those things got to be taken care of. Somebody's got to help you find the mortgage company with the best rate and good service, and the title company, and everybody's got to have homeowners insurance, and they want to shop the rates on those type of things.
What would you say was the biggest challenge you had when you were growing your business?
Biggest challenge probably always, and even today, is recruiting good sales agents and making sure that their honesty and their culture matches up with yours, because you get one person that's in the company that is not giving good service to the customer, it hurts the overall company's reputation. And so when you got 3,000-something agents and they're all are energetic and hungry and trying to make real estate sales, and because that's their living. These are not salaried people. They come to work every day knowing that they've got to make a sale to get a commission in order for them to be able to pay their bills, their mortgage payment. And so you're dealing with many people. Most of them are very energetic and very aggressive, and that's what we want them to be. But probably recruiting agents, and you got to realize that we're not the only game in town. There are other real estate companies, and they're all trying to grow also. So they're calling our agents, and we may be calling their agents. And so we have those conversations with people all the time.
What was the best decision you made?
Best decision I made was to leave where I was, because I felt like I could build, come up with a better real estate company that was more agent friendly. I didn't feel like the company I was with was as agent friendly as they could have been. Agents are independent contractors, and so they can work anywhere. They can go to work for any real estate company, not just us. And so we're kind of in the position that the agent is the customer. You think, well, the home buyer, home seller is the customer. Well, they are. They're the client, but the agent is kind of a customer of ours also. We hire them, we train them, then we provide certain services for them, everything from computers to copy machines to secretaries to accounting officers, all those negotiating contracts. What they used to be negotiating big contracts with the commercial appeal, and now it's nobody cares about newspaper advertising anymore. It's all social media type promotion. Don't get me into the newspaper advertising, but that's a whole nother story. In the old days, newspaper was big, and that helped us grow because we were big enough to make commitments for full pages and a lot of advertising in the newspaper, and smaller companies couldn't do that. And you probably don't remember this, but we were the only real estate company in Memphis that ever had its own television show. We had a Sunday morning television show.
I remember that.
10:30 on Sunday morning, 30-minute show. And you got to see houses and someone telling you about the houses and that type of thing. And that was a home run for us. It helped us recruit agents. It helped us get a lot of listings because television was the thing. People have a hard time remembering back before computers, social media, those things didn't exist.
Yeah.
Television was king. And so we were running that 30-minute television show on Sunday morning. Now, just being the Bible Belt, a lot of people said, now, wait a minute, Sunday morning, people will be in church, won't they? And I said, the preachers wish they were all in church, but they're not all in church. There's a whole lot of people that are out there that don't go to church, and that's who we'll be advertising these to. And it ran again later on. I think it ran.
They could record it on their Betamax back in the day.
Yeah, they could record it on their Betamax. I hadn't heard that term in years, Betamax.
So it sounds like a lot of what you've built is kind of innovative in the industry. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. For instance, the first company that Dick and I were with, you sat in a bullpen area. No matter what your production was, you could be the biggest producer in the whole world. You sat in a little small desk in a bullpen with a phone on it, and because cell phones didn't exist, so you had that phone there. So, well, what about these people that are making big bucks? They're making over $100,000 a year. They're executive level people, and they're in a little tiny desk out in the middle of a bullpen, and they think they should have a private office. So when we did our own offices, we started putting in private offices, and they couldn't get that anywhere else. And the television show, they couldn't get that anywhere else. I had agents with other companies say, I got to join you. I can't compete with you. My homeowners want their house advertised on television, and I can't do that. And we were the first one to have our own magazine. We've done away with that since everything's on the internet now. But we ran a magazine for probably 25, 30 years. It was a magazine came out monthly and had every listing that we had in this market on there. And we had it in all the Walmarts and Walgreens. And you could pick up one of those magazines and see all of the listings.
Did you have any special advisors or mentors that were in the field that helped you as you were growing your business?
The first two guys that we worked for, Harold Sterling, Barry Sterling, they were good mentors, and again, I didn't like some of their leadership management policies that I was their sales manager forced to put in place, but that's a whole other story. But I think you learned a lot. Everyone would say they learned a lot from their first broker. In the real estate industry, you take a real estate course to get your license, but you still don't know anything. It's on-the-job training. You learn enough to pass the test, and the test may be about how many commissioners there are in the real estate. That doesn't teach you how to make a living. I learned how to make a living, how to make a presentation, how to speak to buyers and sellers and that type of thing from them. And then over the years, I'm one of those that takes courses. And so I have my GRI, their CRS, and those are all designations, CRB, Certified Real Estate Broker. Now, those are all designations that anybody that stays in business, they really should continue on with their education. It's kind of a never-ending type thing. It's not just take your real estate course and then you know it all. You learn more after you get that license than you did to get the license.
What about the management and leadership role? What did you do to build that skill set?
Well, again, I'd been in a leadership role, and there are courses that you can take that teach you out of those, like CRB, Certified Real Estate Broker, that teach you some of the leadership deals. But you really have to have, I think, some of that innate mindset to begin with. And other people have to look at you as a leader or someone that they look to when they have questions. For instance, if we have an opening for a branch manager, one of the things that we normally look for is we can go around that office and talk to some of the agents, and we'll say, who do you go to if the manager's not here? Who do you respect? And that sometimes is the right person to take that lead position in that branch. And the state of Tennessee requires that we have a broker. The first level is just a sales associate, affiliate broker, and then the broker is someone that's taken additional training, additional test, and has been in a position to be a leader in an office. And so we're required to have one of those in every office we have. But there's leadership training that you went through. But again, I think through military officer training, again, going back to when you're even high school president, you get that position because people see you as someone that is going to be thinking ahead of what needs to be done, whether it's planning the prom as a high school president, whether it's planning that next branch, going out and finding the location, hiring the engineer, hiring the architect, building the building. We own most of our locations, buildings that we built and we own. And we said, you know, real estate companies don't make a lot of money. They're not that profitable, but they do have to pay a lot of rent. They're in a lot of locations. And so you might as well be paying that rent to yourself. And so out of 100 and something offices that we have, we own probably 60, 70 of the buildings. So we therefore pay ourselves the rent.
So I think you've started to answer this question, but I'll go ahead and ask it. And this is a question we ask everybody in these interviews. Do you think that entrepreneurs can be taught, or are they born to be that in that role?
A little bit of both. If you said, I think I probably had an entrepreneurial mindset in that I had energy and wanted to do more and more and more. If you look back and I started this conversation, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to be when I got out of college. I didn't have to make that decision for 2 years because I had a 2-year Army commitment. Coming out, I still didn't have a clue. Went to work for that box company, Canadian Corporation of America. But after that, I got into real estate. Then I said, I can do this, and I could see a brighter future. I could see how I could be successful and grow it. And so, well, that was the luck of the draw. It was a luck that I wandered into real estate. It wasn't like I went to school to study to be a real estate broker. And I'm thankful that life turned out that way. And looking back, that first company that made me a job offer, I could still been at Container Corporation of America. But I looked at what I was doing with them, and I said the big goal then was I was a management trainee with them. They were going to eventually give me a salesman job. They put me on the road with a car with black tires and a radio. And I go around the Mid-South talking to factories and saying, how many boxes do you need to buy? And I said $20,000 a year was going to be about the max at that point in time that you were going to be able to make in that particular job. And I said, yeah, it's a low-paying industry. I can probably do better. And so I started looking.
I love the description, entrepreneurs want to do more and more and more and more.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Yep. What do you see for the future? Where do you see CryLike and Harold Cry in the next 5-10 years?
We're still growing. For instance, we're just opening up a new office in Villa Rica, Georgia. You never heard of it. It's right off of I-20, going west out of downtown Atlanta. Douglasville, you may have heard of Douglasville. Then Villa Rica, we just bought a building there and opened up a small office there, and that's a growing part of the Atlanta area. And we're under contract to purchase an acre out in on Airline Road here in Memphis in Arlington, with the plan to put an office out there. That's a growing area. Seems to be a fast-growing area, and we've got the land under contract, and we close on it. Architects hired, engineers hired. We'll build a building. It probably takes us a year. We'll be building a building there, and that'll be an additional Memphis office for us.
How much has COVID affected your business and how you do things?
Well, it's affected the business negatively mostly. We were scared to death when it first came out, and our sales tanked badly in March. March, when it first came out, the sales were terrible. We were off 25%. Since then, we've clawed our way back, and sales are off the charts right now. Very, very good. And you have to think about this. We went through 8 years after that last recession where the economy was bad and most of what was selling was foreclosures, REO foreclosures, bank foreclosures. And so the sales were bad during that period of time. But also what you noticed was home building was way, way, way down. And so now that the market's better, interest rates are good, home building is not keeping up with the demand. Plus, what about all the pent-up demand that happened during basically about 6 or 7 years of very little new construction? And so there's a whole lot of new construction that hasn't happened. So there's still a lot of pent-up demand. And the builders that are building, they're selling everything they can build as quickly as they can get them finished. And the hard part for them is getting developable land to put lots on. The city doesn't want to extend sewer. They got a sewer there. Everybody's not in my backyard. Don't want a new subdivision in there because I moved out in the country. You got that NIMBY, we call it, not in my backyard. You got that issue. And so if builders can find lots, they can build houses, and they're selling very, very rapidly. And so that's a current issue that's going on.
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about Memphis. And do you think that being in Memphis had anything to do with the success of CryLike?
I think so. I would have to give Memphis really high marks on that. It's an easy town to be a business person in my opinion. And it has an entrepreneurial spirit, obviously, from the companies that have been founded here. So I think it's a little easier to be successful in Memphis than maybe some other markets. Easier to get around and probably just easier to do business. Again, we're in these other cities and there seem like there's more issues in them. Here, even the terrain is a little easier. We're over in Nashville and it's hard to do subdivisions over there because you're having to dynamite and blast rock to put a subdivision in. Here, you get a backhoe and you can put a sewer line in because you're dealing with dirt versus rock. And it's a little more rolling, a little more level here versus mountainous over there. So I think the city probably goes back to its roots. If you think about it, this was a wild riverboat town. And probably attracted
kind of still is,
and probably attracted a lot of free spirited, individualistic type people that Wild West back in those days. That this was a rough, tough river town. So some of that mentality, I think, grew up here and was still here, and probably in our genes, I guess.
Yeah, it's fascinating how those roots stay there for a long time, isn't it?
Cotton country, and all that's changed, but it still is to a degree.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know is important as a member of the society is that you give back, and I know CryLike has a great reputation for giving back to the community. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's something that we have really enforced with our folks. I give them a lot of publicity on it. When I say blog publicity, We do company-wide, the United Way program and that type of thing. But individually within our offices, each office has their own set of goals and targets for that type of thing. And they normally are supporting local in their particular market charities. And they make it real creative. And we do that for a couple of reasons. One, it brings our agents together and gives them something that they can get behind. For instance, our Mount Juliet, Tennessee office does a sweet tooth auction every year. And the agents in the office, they bake pies, cakes. You say, well, how much could those things go for? We invite the community in, and we have auctioneers, and they auction those items off. And you say, well, you could have a cake that went for $300.
Wow.
And so they raise $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, and that money, they pick a different charity. The last one, they went to a senior housing place there in Mount Juliet. Our Smyrna, Tennessee office does a chili cook-off. They have agents that think they can make a great chili, and they bring it in crock pots, and then you pay so much money to go in and be able to sample each one, and then you say which one is the best, and they get the blue ribbon. That's what they get out of it, bragging rights, but then the money then is raised, and it goes to a local charity. So a lot of that type stuff, car washes even. Each individual office picks something that they're going to do, but then company-wide, we do the United Way. And of course, something that we've done for roughly about 40 years is the Youth Villages 5K. And our folks are the ones that got that started. And we have won the corporate trophy for 40 years in a row, which means we have more people that are going to participate in it from a corporate level. And we can really get behind that and push it. And some people that said, I can't go out and run a 5K. Well, they got a 1 mile fun walk. Can you do that? Well, I'm going to be busy that day. Well, why don't you just donate money and get a t-shirt and you'll be a phantom walker. Somebody else will walk for you. But the main thing is you contributed, and we then get that award again. We got it's almost like a permanent trophy for us that we've got there because we've won it every year for like 40 years.
That's great. Very good. What excites you about Memphis right now?
Memphis, again, has that can-do spirit, and it continues to grow, and it continues to redevelop with the downtown area redeveloping, Overton Square area redeveloping, Poplar Corridor, Union Avenue. So you're seeing a lot of stuff going on. I live in Nashville now, and the whole time I was here, it seemed like the Tigers had losing football teams. Now they got winning football teams. I said, told my wife, how many years do we sit out there and watch them lose? And now we're not even living here to see some of those games. I've been to some of them, but to see them on a regular basis and the basketball teams and stuff like that. But Memphis has continued to grow. Again, I love the baseball stadium. That's a real quality built stadium. It has a lot of class to it.
So that's the blue, the
Redbird
Stadium.
Yeah, Redbird,
yes.
Stadium. Yeah, Memphis was always, in the state of Tennessee, always the big city. They had the big stadium. Nashville didn't have anything. They had the big basketball arena, the roundhouse, they call it. Nashville didn't have anything. So Nashville is now growing, catching up with some of those things. But Memphis has had it for years because it always was the bigger city. And I think the rest of the state was always a little bit jealous of Big Shelby. But I'd always had one on the tag for years.
That's right.
Do you mind sharing what made you move to Nashville?
Primary reason was we were growing fast there, and our growth here had pretty well tapped out because we have an office in every submarket you can think of, Midtown, two offices in Germantown, Forest Hill, Cuyahville, Bartlett, Cordova, Arlington. And so only because Arlington Airline Road is growing now that are we looking at putting an office out there, because we see a lot of growth going that direction with what's going on out in the where Bell's Outlet Mall
the
used
Lake
to be.
District.
Yeah, all that area seems to be where a lot of the growth is going right now, so we're putting an office out there. But back to your question, I had good seasoned leadership here. Brian Robinson, CFO, Steve Brown, general manager, people that have been with us for 25, 30 years. I had no one in Nashville. Me going up on a couple of days a week, but I had branch managers, and that's a little bit like the prisoners running the prison without any leadership, with anyone being there on enough of a daily basis to. And so I said, I think somebody's got to do it. And I'd already been back and forth for like 8 years, driving every week back and forth. That's when we got the plane. And I said, you know, that 3-hour drive, the wear and tear on the body is getting there. And that's when I got the plane. But I said, maybe I need to live up there. We had bought a condo, was kind of living in that condo up there when I was there, so I didn't have to stay in a hotel every time. But that back and forth, I said, you know, let's get moved up there. And my wife was kind of so-so about it for a while, you know, because that means you got to change everything from doctors to beauticians. Everything's got to change, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's the hard part about making a move.
So you got to convince the wife also.
So what do you like to do for fun?
One of the things that people said, well, when are you going to retire? And I said, you know, if it was just based on money, I could have retired a few years back. But what do you do when you retire? And I said, you know, I don't have golf as a hobby. I don't have woodworking as a hobby. I like doing things that like I'm doing now. And so I like growing. I like projects. For instance, I've got a subdivision I'm just starting, a subdivision I'm just finishing, another subdivision I'm talking to an engineer about land I've got. So those are all side projects on top of the day-to-day running of the real estate office. So I've always kept something in the works, I guess, in the wings of doing other things that, again, it relates back to real estate. And so I think probably work is my hobby. Back to your question again. I played golf at one point in time, but it was a frustrating game. You see what direction you want the ball to go, and it goes another direction. So I said, why do I want to spend 4 or 5 hours out here and be frustrated when it's over with? And I said, I can tell I'm not going to be very good at it. And so I don't think anybody can, other than Tiger Woods, ever gets really good at it. But as a duffer, I wouldn't have enough time to go out there and play very often.
It's a common answer from the entrepreneurs. What do you like to do for fun? The answer is, I like to work.
I like to work. People say, when are you going to retire? And I said, and do what? Yeah, you know, we travel. Wife and I, thank goodness we did it before the COVID hit. We just did that European riverboat cruise, went into Budapest and Prague and Vienna, Austria. That was really a cool trip, and enjoyed that. And I said, you know, we get past this COVID, I can see doing that type thing. There's some other ones of those European trips I'd like to do. But and with a 21-year-old son, he wants to do beach stuff. So we've been to most of the Caribbean islands, Aruba and Jamaica and Costa Rica and Dominican Republic. We've been to all-inclusives and those where you lay out on the beach and drink the little drinks with the umbrellas in them and just read a good book and relax. And so that's, if you say what I like to do for fun, it's probably
relax.
A beach vacation with a good John Grisham book.
Yeah, that sounds great.
That sounds real good to me. So what are three things that you could not live without, not including family?
Like your cell phone?
Yeah, which is true, probably.
Cell phone would be probably one of them. I'm not sure. I started to say SEC football, but I think I probably could live without that if I had to. But
nobody would want to.
Yeah, wouldn't want to. We've been season ticket holders for the Titans, but I actually like college football better because it's more exciting than pro football for some reason or another, it seems to me. And you're dealing with the kids that aren't jaded like the NFL players sometimes, I think, are. But travel, love to travel, love to see other countries and look at their history and that type of thing and observe. Some of that stuff we saw on the boat trip was very, very interesting. The architecture is one thing that you're seeing, particularly in places like Prague and Vienna. The architecture, you know, and the fact that they were able to build these castles and cathedrals and churches back 1,000 years ago, and how did they do that without having a power saw? Mm-hmm. How did they do those things and marble? And so I think the travel aspect of it is something that wife and I both like to do, and we're been bummed out about the COVID because you really can't do much traveling right now because of that, but hopefully we're about through with that issue. But I'd say that, and probably projects. I'm always looking for additional projects, things to do. You may remember, maybe don't, it's forgettable, but I bought an old mobile home park here in Memphis about 3 years ago. That's a project for me. People say, why in the world did you buy that? Because I like cleaning things up. That place was a disaster.
Where is it? Where was it?
3070 Summer Avenue. It was called the Leahy Trailer Park.
I remember
for years. You probably don't go down that street because it has been not the At one point in time, it was the main highway, but lately it's probably not the most place that you'd want to be, particularly at night. But and so it, I bought that as a project to clean up, and it was a disaster. I put in all new sewer, all new electric, new asphalt, lighting to hold down, fenced it in, put wrought iron fencing across the front, an automatic gate, so it's a gated community now. Brought in, people have a hard time believing this, I hauled off, crushed, put in dumpsters and hauled off 45 old trailers.
Wow.
And so what's in there now is new. So why in the world you do that? Well, one, most everything is has a potential for money making, and that's a money maker. But to me, I like cleaning up things, and that was a project. It could most people would call it something that you clean up and flip, and that probably will be what happens one of these days.
Well, I actually do drive down there a lot because I have a child on Mud Island, so it's the kind of the way that I go down there.
If you go down Summer Avenue and get towards. Towards Tilburn, it's on the right, and we've got the grass looking good.
Yeah, looks
got
really
some
good.
Landscaping, built a new office in there, put street lights in, worked with light, gas, and water to put on all new power poles and meters, and been buying brand new mobile homes from Clayton Homes. And so that,
giving
the people that are
that's
there much better housing. I think the city I really ought to give me my ribbon or a gold star or something other for
well, it does.
Cleaning up, which was something that was a real eyesore.
And it really, really does look good. And I think, didn't an author write a book living there? There was a famous author that...
From Here to Eternity, Bert Lancaster. That book was written by a guy that lived there one summer. It started out as a RV-type park. They didn't call them RVs back in those days because this was after World War II that it was created by a guy named Leahy. And I think he's deceased, and he left it to his divorced, and left it to his wife, and she ran it into the ground, and got behind on taxes, got behind on utilities, and they were going to cut all the utilities off, and so that's when she put it on the market, and I bought it, and been a project to clean up ever since, and cleaning up the area and making the area safer.
I'm sure the residents really appreciate it. It's a big improvement, so thank you very much. That's really cool.
So what would be something that people would be surprised to learn about you?
Some people are surprised that I was in the military because I've said, I spent a year in South Korea. Really, I didn't know you were in the military. Thank you for your service. So I hear that. And then there's other people that said, did your father start the company? Now, they don't ask me that as much anymore because I got gray hair. But when I was first getting started and we grew very rapidly and we're a big company, and so there was some assumption that maybe had been around for a long time, and maybe my father had started it, and I had inherited it. But no one inherited it. You worked your butt off to get it to where it is now. That's how it got there. And I was in my early 30s when we broke off and started the company, and it's been a good journey. Hell, and life is a journey. It's not always a destination. So it's one of those journeys that you never expect to get to the. There's no ending. You continue to. Manage what you've got every day. And I tell some people that, say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a plate spinner. you know what a plate spinner is?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've seen the guys on Ed Sullivan. Then it goes down and then he has to run back to get the first plate that's about to fall off the stick. Sometimes I think that's what I do. I'm the guy that has to keep all the plates on the stick and keep it all spinning and keep it all going at the same time. And you know, there's 1,000 phone calls and you're dealing with 4,000 personalities, and some people are doing a great job. Some people aren't always doing a great job, and that's why they need. I've always said if the job were easy, they wouldn't need me. And so I'm the guy that has to come in and kind of calm the troops, make the decisions. And sometimes you got to make a decision that some people aren't right for the company and they got to move on and those type things. And that's part of the deal.
Another great description of an entrepreneur, a plate spinner.
I was going to say, and I sure have enjoyed this interview with the number one plate spinner from Cry Like. Harold, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, we appreciate you being here.
Great story. Yeah. So, and if you want to find out anything more about Harold or Cry Like or any of the above, all of the information will be in our show notes. So thank you very much. We hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Harold Cry.
If you want to learn more about Harold Cry, you can find a link to the Society of Entrepreneurs profile in our show notes. Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.